the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, gold's been going up in dollars for the last few years, but something that a lot of times people don't pay attention to is what's happening in other currencies. I mean, right now, isn't gold very, very reactive to like the British pound or the euro?
Kevin, characteristic of this particular bull market is gold and silver appreciating in every currency around the world. And we've talked about this a number of times in which we've basically said the inflation that we experience here in the United States is a rather benign thing. Whether it is the single digit, which the BLS confesses to, or using their older models as high as low double digit, 10.7% using their 1980 methodology, it's still, relative to our national income and the average income for the average American, is insignificant. But what we see globally is an inflation on steroids.
So are we seeing gold react to the inflation that other people are feeling overseas right now?
Well, that's exactly right. You see increased physical demand for metals other places in the world. If you look at the U.S. market, it still is a dominant paper trade where people will trade contracts, people will trade options, but the physical metals, that's really not important to most people here in the United States. Globally, because they're experiencing on-the-street inflation, you're dealing with individual investors who are saying, I've got to do something. Got to do something to protect myself against inflation and against the demise of my home currency. Whether that's the rupee, whether that's the pound sterling, whether that's the euro, in every currency globally, Kevin, gold is moving up, silver has been too, factor in the correction, and they're both in a strong uptrend. Today, you have gold higher, at the highest levels they've ever been in euro and British pound terms. So we've just broken out to new highs. This is, like in the U.S. market, we're fairly fixated on ourselves here in the U.S. and don't realize that gold's in a correction here, and it's not in a correction in other parts of the world, namely the second largest economic bloc on the planet, and then Britain as well, the previous heavyweight in the monetary world. Kevin, we're in a raging bull market across the globe.
Well, what's amazing too, Dave, you and I were talking just recently about how the United States and the public here is so numbed down right now with QE2 and this talk of possibly a recovery. And it's like morphine that has numbed the body. And we're not matching the tempo of the rest of the world. The tempo of the rest of the world is to buy gold and hedge against not future inflation, but actually hedge against the inflation that they're experiencing right now.
It is always a forward-looking project too. It's real world in that they're experiencing something of a money panic today,
right?
But it is with the outlook not really changing. When they look at their monetary authorities, they come to the same conclusion we should hear in the United States. It's the same song, it's just a different verse.
You know, David, today we were talking to Trader Roy before we came into the studio, and he started in this business. This is a man who's been directly into the precious metals business. Actually, he was there for the 1980 bull market, and he put things in perspective. Back during that 1980 period, gold, you would think, was trading in extremely high volume. People understood gold quite a bit at that time. Gold shot up to $850 an ounce. But about $3.5 billion worth of gold was traded per day. He put that in perspective. He says, if you want to see what's really going on right now, guys, $38 billion worth of gold is trading on a daily basis right now. Yet America's asleep. It's not this hyper-energized understanding of gold like it was in 1980 when it was skyrocketing.
Kevin, it's interesting, that perspective. We've basically seen a tenfold increase, a little bit more, from 3.5 to 38 billion in gold traded per day. Two-thirds of that, consistently, from then until now, two-thirds of that was paper, one-third physical metals. Well, Kevin, then as now, we're trading about two-thirds of all volume in gold on the paper side, with
right,
about one-third being physical metals. So what was $1.2 billion traded in physical metals back in 1980 is now $12 to $14 billion of physical metals traded every day. That's a big increase. But then remember this too, the world's monetary aggregates are not up tenfold as the trading in gold is up tenfold. They're up 12-fold. We have far more liquidity in the marketplace today, Kevin, and I think we'll continue to see higher volumes in the metals market traded. Kevin, the biggest transition ahead is when we see that two-thirds traded in paper to two-thirds traded in physicals instead.
Well, you know, when he was putting this in perspective, Trader Roy was also talking about just right now, physical trading is actually, if you figure it out, probably about 3 to 4 times what the entire gold market was, paper and physical before, as far as on a daily basis right now. And he said it's actually these large hedge funds and some of these larger institutions that are buying physical and moving away from margin. You know, David, they've been burned with the rule changes at the commodities exchanges. You know, this drop that we saw in the metals just a few weeks ago was actually precipitated by a man-made event.
Kevin, we're going to talk today about debt, derivatives, and dominoes. And these three things, debt, derivatives, and dominoes, relate very well to the gold market because, as we explored this morning, the growing interest in the physical metals by your commodity trading advisors and your hedge funds is not on the paper side of the trade. They have, in the post-2008 world, become suspicious of counterparties.
Right.
They don't want to borrow money and have to pay back on short notice. They don't want to be any part of a rigged game. They know how well rigged games can be played. And if they're not the ones calling the shots, they're going to be the patsies. They're going to be the ones taken advantage of. The reason why people are moving into gold today, Kevin, is on the basis of an insurance policy being necessary in the context of a devaluation, a concerted global competitive devaluation in currencies, not just the dollar, but as we've seen even today with the euro, gold price in euros and gold price in British pounds. This is a devaluation globally, Kevin. And so you're seeing that response in the marketplace, but people aren't playing games anymore. People aren't wanting there to be any added risk variables in the metals that they hold.
Well, and when you say people, you're talking about the sophisticated investing people. David, when you're talking about people, you're actually talking about sophisticated investors. I mean, the people down on the lower levels of investment right now are being fueled by risk and speculation and shooting for higher returns. It's the large hedge fund manager right now that's battening down the hatches, is it not?
It's interesting, Kevin. We were in the fall of 2008, actually late summer of 2008, and had an interesting conversation with Bill King up in Chicago. He's been in the commodity pits. He's been trading in the financial markets and has been a guest on our program a number of times. And off air, he commented that he had paid off his house recently and added a few ounces to the gold stash. And the interesting thing was, Kevin, these guys have good instincts, and we're seeing a growing number of commentators, writers, traders look at this period of June to October as absolutely treacherous, where we could see a turn in the marketplace, a turn in the stock market. And what is the precipitating event? We don't know. Is it the end of QE2, the end, quote unquote, of QE2?
Or could it be the European situation, Greece?
It could be. And we're going to talk a little bit about the European situation today, Kevin, because it's really critical. There's some undercurrents that are worth taking an appraisal of. And that's where we're going to begin talking about debt, derivatives, and dominoes.
Well, before we get to that, David, let me ask you a question, because when you were in the Bahamas just earlier this year, you know, silver was really perking and starting to show quite a bit of potential. But when asked if you could only own one investment this year, your reply was gold. Now, can you explain your reasoning there? Because there were people who had stocked up on silver and it had paid off, but you still said gold first, and you, without detracting from silver. Explain.
Well, it was interesting, Kevin. Several participants were visibly surprised and they stood up out of their seats and said, well, what about silver?
Right.
You know, and they wanted to know. They had already placed their bets and wanted to know immediately. My response was that while I like and continue to own significant amounts of silver, we're moving into a period of international financial dislocation similar to 2008, with differences being that the governments who were there to bail out the financial markets don't have the balance sheets that they had then.
They're out of bullets.
Exactly. So to step in and bail out the markets this time around will look quite a bit different. Silver would be fine, and I think will be fine eventually, but gold was and is and will be more of a solid choice based on its appeal in the midst of crisis. Real money moves to that particular metal, gold, when other assets are not providing real returns, and silver tends to follow that trend. I had no idea silver would run as it did in the first quarter of the year, but I'm confident that gold will be the standout for 2011.
Okay.
And the part of this, Kevin, does tie directly into what we're talking about with Europe. We had Italy who was put on negative watch. Again, when a company puts a firm or a country on negative watch, whether it's Standard & Poor's or Fitch, they're giving it a one-third probability that over the next 2 years that entity will be downgraded. So Italy has been put on negative watch. Of course, last week we had Greece downgraded three notches. We covered this in our weekly comments on Friday on the wrap-up there. And Kevin, this is what we think is happening. Greece has been an issue within Europe, and the fear there is that contagion will spread within the banking community if there is a reduction in the value of the assets held by those banks that are, in fact, Greek paper.
You know, David, there still is a musical named Greece, and I keep hearing in the back of my head, Greece is the word, is the word, is the word, because really, that's all you see right now on television. It seems to be the focus not only of the Europeans, but it seems to be the focus here in America. Now, those two don't necessarily seem tied together, but are they?
There's two things going on, Kevin. First of all, you've got just the nuts and bolts of the way that a bank would buy different sovereign paper. You know, we had the opportunity to distribute mortgage-backed securities and agency paper for a number of years, and we had investors all over the world look at it and say, okay, wait a minute, I can buy treasuries that yield X percent, or I can buy agency paper, which has the implicit guarantee of the U.S. government,
right?
Not the explicit like the treasuries, but the implicit guarantee, and I'll earn an extra 150 basis points.
What,
1%, 1.5%.
That sounds awfully
more
familiar, David. I mean, let's face it, that's happened here in America a number of times, and it just blew up in 2008.
Right. So the same thing was done in the context of the European banking community, where you could buy euro-denominated German paper, or you could buy euro-denominated Spanish paper.
Or Greek.
Greek paper.
Right.
And earn a little bit more. But one of the things that you are assuming is that Frankfurt had your back, and that the ECB would not allow failure.
Now, so, when you say Frankfurt had your back, you're talking about the European Central Bank. That's where they're headquartered.
Correct. Correct. Right. Yeah, so this is the issue. You had almost an implicit guarantee with these peripheral countries where you may have made a little bit extra, and it made sense from a liquidity management standpoint, from managing your float at the bank. You wanted to maximize the deposits, and so to get paid a little bit more for really not taking any more risk, because after all, the ECB had your back on that. It just made sense. So you bought Greek paper, you bought Portuguese paper, you bought Spanish paper, you bought Irish paper, and that's what's chock full in these banks. So there's two tiers that we're going to discuss real quick, Kevin. One is an obvious exposure that these banks have, and that is directly to this country-specific euro-denominated paper.
So it's they bought paper that the country may not pay on. That's considered a default. That is the obvious risk.
Exactly, exactly. So, I mean, Kevin, when paper is marked down, if those banks have to take a loss on the paper,
right,
or it has to be marked to market because it's trading at a lower level than its original face value, when paper is marked down, it affects that banking institution's leverage ratios, or capital adequacy ratios, as they like to call them. Capital adequacy ratios are just tier one capital plus tier two capital divided by the risk weighted assets on their balance sheet.
Okay, so, but for the guy who doesn't understand that equation, all right, let's face it, credit default swaps are here to help us. We have insurance against these events, David. So this obvious default risk really shouldn't be an obvious default risk because there's credit default swaps.
Tier 1 capital, you're supposed to have a 4% cushion on. So, I mean, if you want to put it in layman's terms rather than CAR and all the fancy names that go with it, you need to have a cash cushion. And if the bank doesn't have an adequate cash cushion, they're in trouble. Now, what's considered an adequate cash cushion for Tier 1 capital is 4% cash.
Okay. That doesn't sound like much.
Not much. For Tier 2 capital, 8%.
Okay.
So what happens is, if you've got a bunch of assets that you own, and they get marked down in value,
right,
all of a sudden you don't have as much in terms of your leverage ratios or capital adequacy ratios. They change in light of the impairment to the asset.
So you have to raise liquidity somehow.
You have to raise liquidity. So what ends up happening is you precipitate either a liquidity crisis or a solvency crisis. This is what they're trying to avoid in Europe. They don't want to see a replay of 2008 where they see one or the other, a liquidity crisis on the one hand, solvency crisis on the other.
Well, David, isn't that what happened to AIG?
Well, that is what happened to AIG, and this is where they're concerned about contagion. If one institution is impaired, others with similar exposures can see that sort of classic run on the bank, where so if the bank doesn't have adequate liquidity, you could have depositors taking out more money than is actual available liquidity, and that causes a real problem for the bank. Kevin, which you were alluding to earlier, the credit default swaps, or CDSs, this is the second part of the problem. So the first problem is pretty nuts and bolts. The first part is...
it's just a lack of liquidity.
Yeah, and if you take a loss on assets, it can impair your management of the remaining assets and affect your liquidity or even solvency in a worst-case scenario. Where there is further complexity in this instance is with derivatives. Derivatives feature prominently in this equation as... credit default swaps have become more popular over the last 10 years in particular. And they've served multiple purposes. They've helped offload risk.
Right.
They've helped hedge out certain parts of risk. And they've also allowed for speculators to come in and make what you might call unidirectional bets, where you're hoping that the market is going to work for you or against you. It's basically a way of shorting a particular asset and profiting when that asset goes down in value.
You know, for the guys who are positive on derivatives, a lot of times they're positive on derivatives because it's supposed to bring safety to the market. That's why I brought it up earlier. I mean, when these things happen, there should be some sort of insurance against that, and that insurance, like any insurance type of product, needs to be spread out over a broad spectrum to reduce the impact in a single area. Now, we saw that go terribly wrong in 2008. Are there CDS derivatives? Is that derivative type of product built into this European paper?
That's the issue, Kevin. AIG covered or insured as a counterparty a number of bets, which they were required to pay on in the event of insolvency or default. And this turned a low probability cash requirement at AIG into a real-time liquidity shock.
Right.
And so, the sums were staggering, and the requirement to pay was immediate, which forced the demise of the institution. This is the issue, Kevin. If we see a default and the ECB is fighting against this, they don't want to see any form of default restructuring. They've got a whole number of new names that they can call this. But any kind of default at all will trigger a credit default swap payment. And the question is, do those counterparties have adequate liquidity? Can they make payment on short notice? Or are they invested such that they can't actually get to the capital they need to make payment on that insurance policy?
So this is why they call it a contagion. I mean, it spreads like the bird flu or something like that. It doesn't just affect a single institution or even a single country or even a single euro group like Euroland. We're talking about a worldwide contagion that could be triggered by a single country going default.
Sure. Well, what was the lesson learned from 2008 from AIG? You have to pay attention to your counterparty risk.
Right.
Know who is making one-way or unidirectional speculative bets, as well as who is hedged and with whom. In other words, who's taken the other side of the bet? You think the asset class that you're interested in, whether that's a Greek bond or an ounce of gold, owning those things to you as an investor for one reason or the other may make sense. Who's betting against you? Who's
right.
betting against you? And it's interesting to know who's betting against you because you need to know how deep their pockets are. They may be able to hold the trade longer than you are and force you to close out the trade. They win, you lose because they had deeper pockets.
So, David, this takes us back to the gold issue. Actually, you eliminate counterparty risk when you buy an ounce of gold because it carries with it its actual buying power everywhere it goes, and you really don't have to know who's betting against you.
It is no one else's liability, and I guess that's the point of owning physicals versus paper gold in any form or fashion. And that's what I think is happening at the institutional level, Kevin. CTAs and hedge funds are realizing that counterparty risk is involved in virtually every asset class they touch with one exception.
And that's gold.
You can even look at a treasury bond, Kevin, and assume that there's counterparty risk in the sense that you're counting on the treasury to remain solvent and make payments on that investment. If they are no longer around or are impaired or restructure, as we're considering with Greece, as we're considering with Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, and a number of other European countries, Kevin, then your counterparty risk is there as well. There really is only one asset, physical metals, that has no counterparty risk.
Again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. So, since gold is not an IOU, and what we're talking about is the default possibly of IOUs, you would think that the banks would be out buying gold and trying to hedge themselves, but the banks are loaded, aren't they, with this IOU counterparty risk?
Well, and this is what we see throughout Europe, Kevin, where your retail franchise banks loaded up with this European paper.
Right.
It made sense on the same basis that buying mortgage-backed securities and agency paper made sense because it paid a little bit more and the risk didn't seem to really factor in. I mean, granted, we may look at that differently today, but throw on the lens of analysis that would have been used 3, 4, 5 years ago,
sure,
before sovereign debt crisis was even in the vernacular.
I would buy something with a seal of approval, you know, of the European Central Bank. Let's face it, it was a completely new currency. It's a currency that finally unified the other currencies. These guys basically gave the thumbs up that they would be behind it.
Yeah, and the interest rates on those loans were reflective not of the individual country-specific credit risks, but rather of a collective obligation to pay, or a collectively assigned credit rating, an average, if you will, of the good and the bad to the benefit of the poorly rated countries.
Okay, now did these banks add any of these credit default swaps to the list? I mean, partially to insure against problems, but then partially to enhance the return.
Well, let's say that I have $100 million worth of Greek paper on my balance sheet. I own the paper. I'm getting paid by the Greek government regularly, and that's fine, but I do have some concern, so I decide to hedge that part of my portfolio. Not completely, but I hedge a part of it.
No different than a farmer, a wheat farmer out there, who possibly will hedge his crop just in case something happens.
I can buy a credit default swap on the Greek paper that I own, and in the case that they do default, I lose on one side of my investment portfolio, gain on the other, and suffer less by having the insurance policy in place. That's the role that a credit default swap can play when used as a hedging instrument.
Well, David, if that was just the only way the credit default swap market worked, it probably would work to a high degree of substance. But in reality, traders come in and start speculating on these credit default swaps, people who aren't hedging against anything. They're just betting against something. I mean, don't you need to know who took the other side of that bet and how much control they have over the outcome?
Well, and I think that's where we're beginning to see a very interesting sub-story, if you will, within Europe. You've got the ECB. And they are not wanting to allow for any default whatsoever.
Right. Well, why? Let me ask you, because restructuring is something that we've seen many times before. Why is there such a fear of restructuring this debt?
Yeah, if you look at the Latin American debt restructuring in the 80s, Kevin, and the Brady Plan that was put in place, it was very common to see debts restructured in 40-50% reduction in principal payments.
Well, and then adding also to the maturities or the length of time that it pays, right?
Sure, sure. You could restructure and a number of different ways, whether it was just a simple haircut or changing the terms of the loan itself. There's some interesting things happening in Europe, Kevin. I think the question remains who has taken the other side of the bet, not as a hedge, but as a speculative bet.
Are we about to go cloak and dagger here a little bit, Dave?
A little bit, because, again, what we've found is that Wall Street, and particularly the financial gurus of our day, when you meet a child who is both bright and clever, you always keep your eye on him.
Right.
Because he's smart, but he may be too smart for his own good.
Are you talking about the Golden Boy or maybe the Goldman Boy?
Or the Goldman Boy. And Kevin, the reason we bring up this concept of cleverness is because what we've seen become more and more common in the financial arena is rigged games, where you're not just betting on the future appreciation of a particular asset class or its decline, but you structure it in such a way that you can't lose.
Mm.
And we watched a number of shenanigans occur, and we mentioned this a few weeks ago on the commentary, back in 2001, with Goldman creating those 13 currency swaps and covering over just how bad the Greek debt problem was then as they were coming into the EU. Okay, so there's been some obfuscation and some subterfuge already put into the context of Europe with Goldman being involved.
Well, and David, you know, Goldman Sachs keeps coming up in non-financial press. I mean, Rolling Stone magazine has had multiple articles on Goldman Sachs, how not only do they package an investment and sell it to somebody, then they bet against it because they knew exactly what was going to happen, that it couldn't possibly pay off. That's criminal.
Well, and I guess what we're looking at is kind of a division of interest, Kevin, between the ECB and the Euro banks, on the one hand, worrying about their solvency, worrying about their capital adequacy ratios, and then London and New York, who have taken out bets on the demise of these peripheral European countries.
They're betting against it, and they're ready to rake in the winnings.
Pounding the drum, default, default, default,
right.
Default.
So, David, let me get this clear. The European Central Bank really would be the loser if there were defaults at this point. They don't want to see defaults. They'd like to see the thing with Greece work out, Spain, Italy, whoever. But you have Wall Street, and you have London, that actually, not the entire market, but the people that we're talking about would benefit dramatically if there was a default.
And I guess the person to ask about who would benefit the most might be Mario Draghi.
Hmm.
Mario is an interesting character. If you look at his CV, he's eminently qualified to be in the financial spheres within Europe, and he is being considered the likely European Central Bank presidential replacement for Jean-Claude Trichet.
Trichet's
term ends in October of 2011. So we have an interesting changing of the guard between now. You're basically looking at whoever's on the selection committee is hard at work now putting together the candidates, the short list of candidates to be approved to become the head of the ECB.
Well, help me on this, though, David. Isn't Mario Draghi an MIT-educated, PhD, economic, brilliant guy? But he's Goldman.
He's got a lot of real-world experience, a lot of academic experience, but some of his real-world experience, sort of the sign of approval or the seal of approval, if you will, came from his tenure running Goldman Sachs as a managing director in Europe between 2002 and 2005.
This sounds to me like putting the fox in the hen house. If the ECB doesn't want to see default and Goldman and the guys in London and in New York are betting against it, why would you put a Goldman man in the ECB?
Right, and would Goldman take proprietary positions that benefit from the demise or the impairment of a client? We need to go back and ask John Paulson this.
Right.
When he made his $3.5 billion on a single bet, was it genius or was it a rigged game? Again, signs of the times, but Wall Street has become a collection point for the particularly clever, not the particularly trustworthy. And that's an unfortunate state of affairs. But you find people who are setting up bets that they can't lose on. And certainly Paulson is one case in point, with Goldman being complicit in that case. The genius of what these men are doing is that they're structuring them legally. So that's where, if you can skirt the legal issues, although you might consider it criminal, although from the common sense level you would consider it fraudulent, all the I's are being dotted and the T's crossed to be considered above board on a technical basis.
You know, David, this reminds me of the late 80s, because in the late 80s you had these guys coming in, the Carl Icahn, these hostile takeover guys coming in, tearing apart single companies, large companies, and selling off the assets. And actually, you would think that the takeover was to save the company, but in reality, it was just to put money in the pocket of the guy who took it over. It seems to me like this has been transferred from a company scale to a country scale or even a continental scale.
Well, Kevin, and I guess that's what's in play here. Again, if you wanted to draw the lines between the interests in Frankfurt and Frankfurt representing the European Union and the European banks, and those interests being very different than what you would find in a New York and a London,
right,
wherein it doesn't matter the way the market goes. We don't live there. It's not our country. It's not our currency. It's not our way of life. It's simply this year's way to make profits, whether that's profiting on the upside or profiting on the downside. It appears that the London interests and the New York interests are deeply opposed to the Frankfurt interests and the ECB. The ECB, Kevin, is arguing against any sort of default or restructuring. What's interesting is they're now calling it not restructuring, but reprofiling.
I see.
That's the latest.
Euphemistic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not a restructuring. It's reprofiling.
And it's the ECB, and as you said, Kevin, it's the ECB and the European banking community. They're the ones that lose in a scenario of default or destruct.
But for every loser, there's always a winner.
Well, you're right. And the winner is clearly not Frankfurt. It's not the ECB. It's not the German, Italian, and French retail banks that hold that sovereign paper in their balance sheets and whose books are currently under pressure. The winner is the person or the financial organizations that have bet against the peripheral countries, you know, making this unidirectional speculative bet on a soft restructure, or as they're now calling it, the reprofiling,
right,
or what other kind of default. It has to be categorically a default sufficient to trigger payment as legally required by the credit default swap contract.
So in a way, David, we actually have a war going on right now between Europe and Britain and America. I mean, it seems to be very similar, but this is just being played out in the financial scheme.
Right. Continental Europe versus everyone else. And everyone else really doesn't care about continental Europe unless you're talking about a currency alternative, in which case Asia certainly cares about the direction of Europe. And on that basis, I think the harder you see the European banks pressed and the ECB pressed to bring about a default with the sovereign paper,
right,
you may see China just step in and spend $100 billion. You may see them come in and spend $500 billion. They certainly have the money to do it. Wanting to see the dollar decline over a longer period of time, this is the Chinese,
right,
would imply that they don't want to see the euro crater and will act as something of a backstop. They may be the knight on the white horse stepping in to save continental Europe from a debt or default restructure.
So what an amazing complexity that's been added to this spectrum. It really is. If you go back and study the makings of a World War I or a World War II from a military political standpoint, it's very complicated. Okay, we like to simplify it and say Hitler was a bad guy, da-da-da-da-da, and he was. But it was far more complex than that. David, being played out in the financial markets, and especially the derivatives market, which, when you add it all up, is the greater part of all the money markets out there. You know, we've talked over a quadrillion when you count all the money. You've got Asia working in their best interest, possibly. That would be a surprise if they come in on a white horse. It certainly would shock the markets. You've got Goldman Sachs working their way into the very thing that could be their payoff, which is Mario Draghi. How do you hedge against these things, David? I guess it brings us back to gold, right?
I think you do want to look at your counterparty risks and realize that every asset class that you own, whether it's a stock portfolio, a bond portfolio, a currency portfolio, a managed futures portfolio, whatever it is, you're dealing with institutions. And if you haven't adequately hedged that institutional risk or counterparty risk, you don't know the context that we're in. Kevin, you're right. We've got Europe fighting New York and London. Europe is fighting what appears more and more to be a rigged game, one in which the Goldman Sachs boys, along with other global financial speculators, are playing for keeps. Again, in an already rigged game. They know how bad the numbers are because they came in with these sovereign entities and helped obscure originally just how bad it was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago. So they know exactly what they're betting. They have put together the portfolios which they can now short and profit from.
And now they're sending their man in, Draghi.
This is if and when Draghi comes to the helm of the ECB, you'll have your default delivered over to London and New York hedge funds. Goldman will make a killing. Goldman may play for keeps, and this is what will be interesting. They stand to benefit in two ways, Kevin. One, certainly financially. If Draghi comes in, as a former Goldman man, you know that the ECB's hard stance on a default or restructuring goes away, and the logic of default, the logic of restructuring, all of a sudden becomes a part of the ECB tune.
So are they doing this all for profit, David, or is there more?
No, because frankly, Kevin, London and New York benefit more significantly by translating that money and profit into power within the Eurozone.
Hmm.
So certainly money means something, but it means less when you're making billions a quarter. Power is the next best thing, Kevin, frankly, to being God in a kingdom of your own making. And that's what Goldman has a vision of. Now, we're not just picking on one firm. There's other firms involved in this particular game, Kevin.
Sure, J.P. Morgan, I'm sure Morgan Stanley.
And there's tons of hedge funds that are on board as well, Kevin. You know, it's not difficult to see that we have mismanaged our own books here in the United States.
Let's go mismanage the ones in Europe.
Right. What you have is the new form of financial wizardry is setting up a package of securitized products that you can't lose when you bet against. That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing, and something that will ultimately change as there's a public outroar against it. This was never meant to be. If you go back to Greenspan's speech in the 90s about how wonderful derivatives were, he envisioned derivatives for the financial market being, as you described, Kevin, a way that someone who brings in corn or wheat or soy is able to hedge their current production and lock in today's price so that they don't have to experience the vicissitudes of the market, the ups and downs and volatility, the commodity trading pits. They were essentially hedging. That's what derivatives were intended to be. They have become truly weapons of mass destruction, financial weapons of mass destruction, and the war that's being waged is continental.
Well, you know, David, one of the ways that the average guy can actually measure risk, like the risk of default or what have you, is by watching interest rates. Now, don't the credit default swaps in some way let us know what the likelihood for these various countries is for some sort of default or other kind of non-paying event.
Well, Kevin, this is why we're coming, why we're talking today about debt, why we're talking today about dominoes and the falling of one domino leading to a fall of another, why we're talking about derivatives and derivatives being central to this fall of the dominoes within the debt markets in Europe, is because we already have credit default swaps, the insurance that you pay against default, at higher rates than we had a year ago when the ECB was bringing out their $1.1 trillion or 750 billion euro bailout. This was the giant shock and awe. We're going to change Europe. We're going to backstop every country. There will be no defaults. We're going to implement austerity. And here's all the money the world could ever want to fix the problem. And yet, Kevin, 12 months on,
it's worse.
The situation is worse, and the probabilities of default, as indicated by credit default swap pricing, is even higher. Kevin, take these countries in Europe as the primary example. In Greece, if you've got $1 million that you want to insure, it's going to cost you $147,000 per year to insure it.
Just to insure it?
Yeah.
So you're talking almost 15% just to insure.
15% to insure something that pays 16.7%. You're eking out a marginal profit, but you have to insure against default. It's costing you almost 15% to insure against default. In Portugal, it's better. It's only $67,000 for every $1 million, or 6.7%. In Ireland, it's 6.6%. In Spain, it's 2.68%. In Italy, it's 1.69%. So you can see, Kevin, where the concern is most concentrated. Greek, Portugal, then Ireland, ultimately Spain. The real revolution, Kevin, will be over the next few months as we see things materialize, particularly in Spain, and it goes from the bottom of the list to being near the top of the list.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, you know, some people that I've read and we've talked about, Greek debt isn't necessarily the big issue. Even Portugal debt is not really the big issue.
And it's because they don't have that much to speak of.
But Spain is a different issue, isn't it?
Spain and Italy are two borrowing giants. I mean, there's tons of paper, and that's the issue. Is it, again, on the basis of contagion, it's not that you have to worry about Greek debt defaulted.
That wouldn't take the ECB down or the euro land down.
It wouldn't. It doesn't destroy the euro project. Portugal, if you face default or a restructuring in Portuguese paper, again, it doesn't impair the EU project.
But these are these dominoes, David, that you're talking about. One domino leading to another.
Exactly.
Leading to
the big one that you can't recover from is because there's too much debt is Spain, and then Italy even more so. But with Spain, you know, since 2008, Kevin, you've got 17 autonomous regions, like our states practically, which have doubled their debt to $160 billion. You've got municipal debt, so the cities within those states, which have debt that's right around $50 billion, $47, $48 billion.
Right.
And then central government debt, which in dollar terms is pushing $700 billion. Yeah, this is in addition to about $37 billion, Kevin, worth of debt that hasn't been factored in because, you know, it's being considered as unpaid bills and things of that nature. So they haven't actually added an extra $37 billion to the negative side of their balance sheet. Spain is a far bigger problem than Greece, Portugal, and Ireland. Contagion spreading to Spain would be terminal for the EU project as we know it.
Well, David, since we're on the subject of musicals, we talked about Greece, but I think maybe Greece isn't the word. It's the rain in Spain. We just don't want it to fall, do we?
Unless it's mainly on the plane.
That's right.
I think, Kevin, when you look at the debt that's in Europe, this is not a European problem only. We have that clearly in the United States, too. Our balance sheet is just as impaired as many of these European countries. We have what they don't have, which is an exorbitant privilege, as Barry Eichengreen has described it, that of world reserve currency status. As that gets chipped away at, Kevin, we're in the same boat as these folks are too. And you've got the Chinese central bank advisor, I can't remember his name, but just this last week saying again, eventually he expects to see a default of U.S. paper. Kevin, that may be a far-fetched notion for U.S. investors today, and maybe that's something that will only happen on a 5 and 10 and 15-year time frame. But, Kevin, when you see a revolution in interest rates, when you see a revolution in the bond market, these things never happen gradually.
Well, David, I think probably one of the greatest signs of seeing that our sovereign debt is going to be defaulted on is just watching the Goldman guys. If we knew that Goldman started betting against the dollar ever paying up, we probably should run for the hills, shouldn't we?
Well, you've already got the PIMCO guys saying we don't want any part of the U.S. Treasury market, which is a first strong indicator that short positions will be building over the next few years. So, Kevin, I think as we look at modern finance as a truly rigged game. This is where the smart money begins to figure out who their counterparties are and how they can insure against default, whether it's domestically, whether it's with their own currency, whether it's with a particular financial institution. And that's where individuals and institutions and hedge funds and even central banks are all turning to gold as that insurance.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.